This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 25th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck, coming up in the next 60 minutes. Once known as Afghanistan's Guantanamo Bay, Bagram Prison was today handed over to Afghan forces by the US Army. We examine its past and look at its future. And after a bailout deal is finally agreed upon, time now to reflect on the future of Cyprus and its relation with Russia.
I think the Cypriots feel very, very let down by the way that Moscow has behaved. There was the expectation that in their hour of need that Russia would provide them with the financial aid that the European Union wouldn't. That's obviously not come to pass.
Pim Fox of Bloomberg TV brings us up to speed on the international business news of the day.
One of the things that's happening this week is the owner of Birdseye Frozen Peas is going public. It was bought by a private equity firm and they think that the market is now ripe.
Then we'll round up the news from the east coast of America and head to the Brazilian tailors to get measured.
Brazilians will no longer have to adjust their clothes after years of buying ill-fitted garments. Enforced sizes will now be introduced in the clothing market by the end of the year, something new to most Brazilians.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The United Nations Special Coordinator of the Middle East Peace Process, Robert Seri, has today called for fresh diplomatic efforts between Israel and the Palestinian territories.
Mr. President, both Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas reiterated their commitment to the two-state solution as essentially the only prospect for the future of Israelis and Palestinians, while they undeniably differ on its terms and how to attain it. It is incumbent upon us as the United Nations and the international community to help them bridge those differences. Much work lies ahead.
Peace talks ran aground in late 2010 in a dispute over Jewish settlement building in land Israel captured in a 1967 war. Palestinians say they need this land for a state. Last week, the US President Barack Obama met with leaders on both sides during his visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories, but offered no new peace proposals. Zambia has today officially charged former President Rupia Banda for abuse of authority over a Nigerian oil deal. Banda, who led Africa's top copper producer from 2008 to 2011, has maintained his innocence. Cyprus is to shut down its second largest bank and inflict heavy losses on uninsured depositors in return for a 10 billion euros bailout. The plan will spare the Mediterranean island a financial meltdown by winding down the largely state-owned Popular Bank of Cyprus, also known as LACI, and shifting deposits below 100,000 euros to the Bank of Cyprus to create what's known as a good bank. Jeroen Dijsselbloem is the current president of the Eurogroup.
The instruments that we're choosing now could have been chosen a week ago, but they couldn't have been chosen a week ago because there simply wasn't a political possibility to reach that agreement. So within the political possibilities last week, we chose different instruments, and now we have the better solution in worse circumstances.
The US military has given control of its biggest detention facility in Afghanistan to Afghan authorities today after months of negotiations. The handover took place a year after both the United States and Afghanistan initially agreed on the transfer. NATO commander General Joseph Dunford said the transfer did not signal an end to US engagement with Afghanistan.
It's a small step towards a transformation that will occur in the years ahead. And let there be no doubt, transformation for those that wear the uniform of the United States does not mean the end of the mission or abandonment. Our mission is changing, but our commitment is enduring. We share the same goals as the people of Afghanistan: development of a nation that protects human dignity.
Here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has unveiled a sweeping immigration crackdown today. Under his plans, access to Britain's National Health Service will be curbed. New migrants will have to wait up to 5 years for social housing. Fines for employers who hire illegal workers will be doubled. And landlords who let to illegal immigrants could face fines too.
We've made significant changes to our policies in the Home Office to get net migration down. But now what we need to do is to work across government so that our immigration policy is factored into our benefit system, our health system, and our housing system. And let me set out how we're going to do this. By stopping our benefit system from being such a soft touch, by making entitlement to our key public services something migrants earn, not an automatic right, and by bringing the full force of government together to crack down on illegal working.
And finally, while Moscow digs itself out of a huge snowstorm that hit the Russian capital in the last few days, organisers of the Winter Olympics are worried that a lack of snow could become a problem next February. Unseasonably warm temperatures this winter in Sochi have forced local organisers to store some 450,000 cubic metres of snow in the nearby Caucasus Mountains that surround the subtropical Black Sea resort. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's 18:06 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Boasting a checkered history that includes allegations of abusing prisoners, violent protests after an albeit inadvertent burning of copies of the Quran by US soldiers, and suicide attacks that led to the deaths of US forces, America has finally handed over the notorious Bagram prison to Afghan forces. Although, strictly speaking, it's no longer called Bagram. Aware of its toxic image, the prison was renamed Parwan Detention Centre and also given a minor relocation. It was perhaps an acknowledgement by the US that, to succeed in Afghanistan, they must even now try harder at winning hearts and minds. With us to reflect on the significance of this change of control is defence correspondent and Monocle regular Robert Fox. Robert, thank you very much for joining us. Can I ask you, first of all, a very simple question? What do the Afghans actually inherit today?
They inherit rather a dodgy detention centre, and prisons in Afghanistan have a very poor reputation. When I first went there, it was the end of the Soviet era, and under President Najibullah, there was the infamous Polichaki, the prison outside Kabul itself, to I think, the east. And it still sends shudders down people's spine when you mention Polichaki. Well, the Bagram facility acquired that reputation. It was partly mistaken principle by the Americans, but as a detention center. We can go into what that meant, and it meant a lot more than just a detention center in Afghanistan. But it also underlines a thing that hasn't been brought out, the extreme difficulty international forces had over detention. They did not know what to do with the prisoners. For a long time, when the justice system was virtually down, what did you do with them? Did you try them? You couldn't hold them forever. Did you return them? Which they did a bit of. They returned to the field and carried on as Afghans, which meant sort of, for some of them, being part-time Taliban. But I think it was a mistaken project. It should have been done much earlier. And this is symbolic. It's symbolic for some very interesting reasons.
Before we just quickly look at that, so I understand there's roughly 3,000 people are said to be held there. Are these all people who have been accused of, you know, crimes associated with the Taliban?
Broadly, yes, but one really never knows with some of these people who get swept up in these big dragnets, as it were. Had they just got on the wrong side of a tribal chief? Was it? It's all very well to jab the finger and say, "Oh, Taliban, you're terrible." And in some areas they've accepted the Taliban and they've accepted the mobile courts, as it were. It is very difficult to identify these people from time to time, although the high-profile ones, as we know, and this is why there is a dreadful symbolism, were extradited or were transmitted. And we're talking about illegal extradition there, and ended up in Guantanamo Bay. And it is the synergy between those two places which I think made Bagram, and it has been for a long time, a toxic brand for the US and the US public.
Now, the Americans have kind of delayed this handover because I think they're being concerned what would happen to some of those prisoners in there. Hamid Karzai has said that actually within the next couple of weeks he intends to go to Qatar to talk to the authorities there about the opening of a Taliban office. So although the Americans feel that they've got some security about, you know, some guarantees around what will happen to the most high-profile prisoners, do you think that actually Hamid Karzai is keener to let as many people out as quickly as possible to kind of shore up his position?
I think Hamid Karzai is very keen for a deal, because what is most obscure in Afghanistan at the moment in Afghan politics is what happens after Hamid Karzai, because he's due to be replaced by a new elected president. He can't stand again in 2014. But there is no obvious candidate at the moment, and there is no doubt about it that Karzai and Karzai's interest, should I say, the family, his position in the Popalzai tribe, they're trying to hang on to power. It's a very, very traditional Afghan story. But also part of the symbolism of the Americans handing it over, now they want to get out. We're on the glide path for getting out. They will declare a stand back for most of the Allied forces from combat operations, except under special circumstances, by about June, and then they'll be gone by January. This is quite clearly the Obama timetable, which is much, much faster than some of the European allies. And you have to lump in with the European allies. They're significant in quality, although not in number. People like the Australians, who go more with the Europeans now, it seems, in many places than they do with the Americans, the New Zealanders, fought very bravely, the Danes. And, of course, the Canadians have just stepped down from combat operations, but in a very crucial area in Kandahar. And the general feeling from serious people, including counter-narcotics people, who are extremely worried about what's going to happen, it's going to explode, if it hasn't exploded already, and what that means with terrorism, they're trying to say, whoa, to Washington. But Washington is not listening to whoa from any ally at the moment.
Just returning to the Bagram base at the moment, as we said, it was kind of rechristened. But what do you think will be the legacy of that for America, for and Americans as well, not just within in Afghanistan? It has become associated with, you know, very questionable activities, with, you know, the borderlines of torture, all sorts of things. Do you think this is going to be one of those names that attaches itself to American history in a kind of in a toxic way for a long time?
I think it does. I think it does to people who are really interested in this, because, as you say, you know, this sort of extradition, which never was extradition and was gilded with the most sinister euphemism of extraordinary rendition. Well, Bagram was part of all that. And I think that that's why it is a very toxic brand. You used in your intro the phrase, you know, the awful cliche of counterinsurgency operations, of winning hearts and minds. I mean, they lost a lot of hearts and minds and goodwill over things like Bagram. They know it. I just think it is one of the symbols of this is the end of that. But the real fear, as I say now, is that there is such pressure from Congress and there's such pressure on the defense budget in the US, and defense has always run these things, that they're going to go way below critical mass. So they probably, there is now a big question behind closed doors about whether they're going to be able to mount a credible counter-terrorist operation after mid-2014. And that's what is still needed, because they're out there. Al-Qaeda in places like Kunar province, which are where there's a war going on. It's not much reported. There's a real war. They're resurgent. They're a new mix. They're very, very local, but there are big international implications. And they're back in the saddle, and they're pointing in different directions. And who is as worried about this as the Americans? Here's a funny thing. The people who are next door up the Wakhan Valley, the Chinese.
And just finally to conclude, do you think that when America looks back at this kind of extraordinary period and all the things it's got involved with, and as things tumble away over the next year as the Afghans take over, and we've already seen how kind of corrupt and how kind of incompetent many of the people taking over are in the Afghan police and the army, do you think they'll look back in a year and wonder what it was all about?
I think they do, and I think they do that already, and I think that that's a huge mistake. because even in sort of middle-brow journalism sort of thing that you and I practice, there is a sort of terrible nostalgia in industry. And I'm reading that wonderful book about the first British-Afghan war by William Dalrymple, which is a bestseller at this season. It's a terrific piece of scholarship, terrific piece of research, but wrong in one conclusion. And he really, the thesis of the book can be summed up in the great Yogi Berraism. It's deja vu all over again. It's not true. Afghanistan has changed colossally in the last 5 or 6 years because they're all buying into the same information space. Taliban and the Americans and the NDS, the National Security Service, all use the same information space, whether it's IT, and they do use it, Taliban do use it a lot, or the mobile phone network. There is no landline network worth a damn in Afghanistan. You get 80% mobile coverage, which is better than you get in rural Somerset, I tell you. And so it's very, very interesting. It is look, Afghanistan is much more novel than it is being given credit for.
Brilliant. Well, there's lots of things that I know that we're going to catch up with you over the coming weeks. But Robert, privilege always to have you here in the studio. Thank you for all of your insights. Coming up, a look at the relationship between Cyprus and its old friend, Russia.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, after a week that Cyprus would kind of like to forget, an 11th-hour bailout deal was reached earlier today with the troika of the ECB, European Commission and the IMF that secured the funds to prop up the island's banking system. The once cosy circumstances of life in the warm Mediterranean tax haven have been replaced with fears of widespread unemployment and recession. Much of the blame is being laid at the feet of its relationship with Russia, whose entrenched presence in the Cypriot economy and banking system irked the ECB and Berlin into their tough stance on the terms of the bailout. It's been a presence at times associated with gangster capitalism, but has also been strategic for Russia. Dr. James Kerlinsky of the European Institute at the London School of Economics joins us now to reflect on this relationship. Now, James, we spoke once before about this, and I think that you have a kind of more sympathetic view of the Russian presence in Cyprus. But what do you think is going to be the strains on their relationship over the coming days?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the Cypriots feel terribly, terribly let down by Moscow. After the what they saw at that point were tough terms were presented about 10 days ago and were rejected by the Cyprus Parliament, they rather hoped that Russia would come to their aid and would provide much better or more favourable terms, and it just didn't happen. I think that's come as a real shock to many Cypriots.
Now, the presence of the Russians within the banking community is well known there, and that they had large deposits there. And the reasons for those, it seems to be varied. Some of it certainly does seem to be with dodging taxes, but that's not only a Russian habit, let's be honest. But other people were obviously investing there. But a piece in the FT today by Misha Glenny says that the Russian presence in the Cypriot banking system is breathtaking, far larger, you know, than Cyprus's GDP, indeed. Do you think that we'd kind of underestimated how much money the Russians were pumping through Cyprus and, you know, cleansing to kind of money launder almost in a way to go back to Moscow?
Well, in actual fact, I mean, I take rather a different view. I think that we in many ways, the coverage of this has overestimated Russian presence in Cyprus. I mean, it's very, very easy, and it makes for a great story that Russia has got this sort of stranglehold on an EU member. And, you know, in this day and age where we talk about a lot about tax avoidance and various schemes and tax evasion, that Cyprus was somehow this den of not only tax evasion, but it was something much more insidious than that. It was all this money laundering. The reality is that, yes, no one doubts for a moment there's large amounts of Russian money in Cyprus. No one doubts for a moment that some of that is tainted. But I think it's very easy to get out of hand and sort of, which is exactly what I think Germany has done, which has come to see as being completely all-dominant in Cyprus. It's not at all. There are many, many other businesses that have opened up in Cyprus from many countries. A lot of British have gone to the island and set up businesses. It's got a large shipping industry. It really is across the board. Plus also then all the deposits that have come from sort of people, for example, who've retired out there and things. So as I say, I think it makes for a great story. But the reality is, I don't think that the Russian presence was actually as large as many people seem to think.
And let's be honest, if you went to Belgravia here in London, I think you'd find rather a lot of Russian money holed up here, and not all of it as squeaky clean as some people would like to think as well. But returning to the Cyprus story, do you think there have been strategic implications as well, which perhaps the Europeans were kind of keen to undermine in a way?
Yes, I mean, There's no doubt that Cyprus and Russia have had a close relationship, but and this stretches back 50 years. I mean, it goes back to the very earliest days of the Cyprus Republic, when the first conflict broke out between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. There was talk of introducing a NATO force. The Greek Cypriots have always been very suspicious, traditionally very suspicious about NATO, feeling that this organization would always put Turkey's interests above their own. And so that's when they first introduced the Soviet Union into the situation. There's a counterbalance, and I think it's important to stress that term, counterbalance. This is not about Cyprus taking a Russian side over a Western side. It's always sort of felt itself to be in a very difficult position, has had to take its friends where it can get it. And when, as they feel in their own minds, I don't think this is entirely accurate, but they've got Britain and the United States against them. They've always felt Russia has provided some sort of backstop to all of this that helps them. But the reality is that that's actually changed significantly in recent years. You had a hardline communist president, but at public level and amongst all the other major parties, there's actually been a much greater sort of sense of opening up to Western institutions, and most notably NATO. It's very telling that the new Cyprus president, during his campaign, openly said he wants to see Cyprus join Partnership for Peace and eventually to join NATO itself. This is not really the language of somebody who sort of lives in the view that Russia is all important.
Well, James, thank you very much for joining us. That's Dr. James Kalinzi, who's been commenting on Cyprus for us over the last couple of weeks. Many thanks for your time. Now, in a moment, there's going to be more from Europe.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouse by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. We continue in Europe now, where immigration has become the topic that even the left are now keen to debate and prove they're not soft on. In Britain today, Prime Minister David Cameron has called for tougher rules, citing a more get-back-what-you-put-in mantra that he says would stem the tranche of migrants supposedly sponging off the British benefit system. So, is one of the founding ideals of the European model, that of open borders and the free movement of workers, being erased? Dr. Richard Wellings, Deputy Editorial Director of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and Hugo Brady, Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for European Reform in Brussels, join us on the line now. Dr. Wellings, could we start with you? First of all, in a UK kind of arena, what do you think we're seeing happening? Every single political leader has made a big speech about immigration over the past few days and couple of weeks. Do you think we are seeing a kind of a different take on what immigration means for the UK?
Well, I'm not sure how genuine it is amongst the party leaderships, but they are reflecting the fact that immigration always polls very high, as close to top of the list of voters' concerns. And we've recently seen the rise of the United Kingdom Independence Party, a right-wing populist party, and they've played the immigration card pretty hard. So really, I think they're reflecting voters' concerns, and they don't want to give ground to the United Kingdom Independence Party, who've put up a very strong electoral challenge recently.
And do you think that, you know, if you're a party leader, that you actually do have to just begin to listen to kind of populist opinion, even if it doesn't make kind of economic sense sometimes?
Well, obviously they're looking forward to the elections in 2015, the general election. And also, obviously, they're afraid of a drift towards extremism, as we've seen in some of the other countries, looking at, for example, at the success of the Front National in France and so on. nonetheless, I think within the legal framework within the European Union, there isn't really that much that the politicians can do about immigration anyway. So a lot of it's just bluff and rhetoric.
Hugo, tell us, we're saying that there's not much that they can do. It is a bit bluff and rhetoric, that we're kind of all tied into this big EU project. Do you think that's true?
Well, I tend to agree because across Europe, not just in Britain, the idea that, a migrant can come to your country and start drawing rather generous welfare benefits immediately is just as politically controversial elsewhere as it is in Britain. I think the difference is that it's harder to get into the more generous welfare systems of other European countries. I mean, you see the pattern. It's as sort of hypocritical as it is in Britain. For example, Nicolas Sarkozy made immigration, including EU free movement, a big plank of his. Indeed, he made reform of the EU's Schengen rules, which are very much linked to free movement, a major plank of his re-election campaign. And he made it far more difficult for family members to join workers in France if they happened not to have European nationality. But in the end, French voters weren't convinced enough by his promises on immigration to ignore his economic record. So to a certain degree, the immigration debate is rather confusing because voters seem to want political action, but not something that makes them feel worse about themselves.
And you say that this is a debate that's not just in the UK, that's happening through other kind of Western economies. But do you think it's a kind of bit of a north-south divide? Obviously, the strains that we are seeing on the southern economies and the kind of desire for a better life in EU members in the Balkans, for example. Do you think that within all those countries, there is this kind of desire to kind of rush north that we're told about in our newspapers and by some of our politicians? Or do you think that's slightly a fiction?
Well, I think that, first of all, if you have a European Union, as you alluded to in your remarks at the beginning, you have to have a single European labour market to make it work. And it's also very much the logic of globalisation, so we'd have some version of it, whether or not the EU was the political project it is today. But it very basic political bargain of Europe has always very much been that countries, workers from the Mediterranean, head to the more flexible labour markets of the north. And that's been true since before the Second World War. So in many ways, we're just seeing the same sort of cycles playing themselves out, perhaps aided by the greater freedoms that the EU brings. Because if European integration means anything to ordinary people, surely it means freedom of movement. For example, you've got over a million UK pensioners bronzing themselves under the Spanish sun. And in order to buy that right to be able to move to another country, buy property with ease, settle there, the southern countries, part of the deal is that they get to move north and get a job where it's easier than in their own territories. So any attempt to fundamentally unsettle that bargain probably would undermine the very core of the EU and the single market itself.
And Richard, tell me, lots of the debate going on in the UK seems to be kind of panic that hordes of Romanians and Bulgarians are heading our way. Do you think that that's the real reason this debate has got so sharpened over the last few weeks, as we're seeing restrictions on the movement of those workers, that this is the panic that's kind of got behind our politicians?
Yeah, I think so. And it's important to remember that there is a difference between some of the previous accession countries like Poland and Romania and Bulgaria. I mean, they are quite a bit poorer than Poland. So you would expect, all things being equal, a greater flow. Though they're also further away, which would reduce the effect. But you are looking at a situation where probably a family of four on benefits in the UK would earn more than the average Romanian who is in a low-paid job, for example. So there will be a big economic incentive to move. But nonetheless, there will also be benefits from immigration in terms of new skills and a more flexible labour market, some opportunities for firms as well. So it's difficult to predict exactly what the effect will be.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us to take part in some of the debate that's certainly kind of swirling around in the UK at the moment. That was Dr. Richard Wellings of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and also Hugo Brady, who's at the Centre for European Reform. Thank you for your time. Now, in the next half hour of this programme, we're going to round up the international business news with Bloomberg TV's Pim Fox. We're going to fly to the east coast of America to get the latest news from our New York bureau. And we're also going to head to the shops of Brazil to get measured up.
Brazilians will no longer have to adjust their clothes after years of buying ill-fitted garments. Enforced sizes will now be introduced in the clothing market by the end of the year. Something new to most Brazilians.
But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The United Nations Special Coordinator of the Middle East Peace Process, Robert Seri, has today called for fresh diplomatic efforts between Israel and the Palestinian territories. Peace talks ran aground in late 2010 in a dispute over Jewish settlement building in land Israel captured in a 1967 war. Zambia has today officially charged former President Rupia Banda for abuse of authority over a Nigerian oil deal. Banda, who led Africa's top copper producer from 2008 to 2011, has maintained his innocence. Cyprus is to shut down its second largest bank and inflict heavy losses on uninsured depositors in return for a 10 billion euros bailout. The plan will spare the island a financial meltdown. And the US military has given control of the Bagram Air Base, its biggest detention facility in Afghanistan, to Afghan authorities today after months of negotiations. The handover took place a year after both the United States and Afghanistan initially agreed on the transfer. And that's the news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. The time here is 18:32 in London, which means it's 12:32 in New York. And that's where we're going to head now to catch up with our associate editor in the New York Bureau, Barrett Austin, who's going to take us through a few of the stories making the news today in America. Barrett, first of all, let's start at the Met. The Metropolitan Museum is in a bit of trouble because someone's filed a lawsuit claiming that they're being kind of rattling their bucket too loudly.
Yeah, I think this is something that will ultimately be passed away as something of a nuisance lawsuit. The whole idea here is that for the past couple of decades, the Metropolitan Museum hasn't necessarily required visitors to pay money, but at the same time, they offer a recommended donation. So anyone who's coming in, if you're an adult, you're recommended to pay $25. If you're a student or a senior citizen, maybe you'll pay $17. But the idea here is a couple of tourists from the Czech Republic and one New Yorker have filed a lawsuit against the museum saying that they're essentially misleading anyone who comes through the doors. Apparently, research shows that as many as 41% of those who go into the museum are actually paying the full $25. So it's kind of a bizarre lawsuit, but one that nonetheless has caught our attention.
Bit mean. I think it's more than fair enough. If people want to pay, they're not exactly having a kind of shotgun put at their head. Okay. Well, poor old.
Yeah, man. I think it's all a little bit odd because if you look at the endowment of at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they've got something like $2.5 billion in the bank, And if you look at their annual report with their operating expenses, less than 10% of the money that comes from museum admissions actually goes toward this. At the same time, I think it is wise that they continue to collect money for this. But nonetheless, the point is, and anyone will tell you this, administrators at the museum, you don't have to pay $25. They say just pay something. If it's a penny, if it's a dollar, 5 cents, $5, anything like that, they'll let you in the doors.
Now, Barrett, another story is that the U.S. government is kind of encouraging hacking at school. What kind of?
Yeah, for the first time, the U.S. government is really trying to bring in high schoolers who, for the longest time in this country and elsewhere around the world, we've really sort of looked at high schoolers as the ones who would be the great hackers. But now you're looking, and there are a couple of government agencies that are actually doing their part to encourage young people to start hacking. And they're not looking for young people to do it in any sort of offensive or... They're not looking for young people to hack into foreign governments' computer systems and tear down their infrastructure. But they're just trying to bring the idea of hacking into public light so that perhaps there will be some greater focus on educating young people of the potential benefits of being hackers on behalf of the U.S. government in the future.
Well, I don't think they'll need my help. I just had to get someone to come in the studio to show me how to turn the computer on, so that's unlikely that I'll be able to...
I always thought you knew how to use computers pretty well there.
Something very strange went on. I literally had to kind of get assistance in the studio to continue with the show. Now, dinosaurs, talking of dinosaurs, there's me. The dinosaurs, they may be coming back, though.
Finally, you bring something up that I'm very excited about. The whole idea is the concept of de-extinction. Now, the idea of de-extinction, and it's a very funny word, I have to give you that, but it's something that's not new, but it's gaining a lot of traction. The idea is that you take a species that has gone off the face of the Earth in the past 1,000 years or so, take their DNA through an unusual process of artificial insemination, you end up bringing a species back to life. So now the ones that are being talked about are species like the American passenger pigeon, the very famous woolly mammoth, a whole host of other animals that could potentially come back to life. Dinosaurs, I don't think that's going to happen. The idea is that DNA has a shelf life, so something like the Tyrannosaurus rex, which has been off the face of the Earth for, say, 1 million years, there's no chance that you could replicate that. But... it's possible that we will see maybe the American woolly mammoth in the year 2015.
I'd love one. Do you think they would also be able to use it to kind of bring back an air stewardess with a smile? That'd be quite good, wouldn't it? Because they're completely extinct.
I don't know. I think, to be quite frank, you and I have both had plenty of experience with that breed. Woolly mammoths are ones that we're not familiar with. But to give my honest assessment, I think that we are more likely to see woolly mammoth roaming the face of the earth, perhaps even flying airplanes, before we see these air stewardesses smiling at us.
I just imagine that if they do bring back the woolly mammoth, they'll probably bring it back in handbag size, so that Paris Hilton could have one. That'd be quite nice seeing the little trunk poking out the handbag.
And looking back at the great affection that we all had for the animals at Monocle's Summer Fair last year, perhaps Nathan the Pig.
We love Nathan the Pig.
I think we should do everything that we can to contribute to the de-extinction process and perhaps have some of these small animals at Monocle's Summer Fair this year.
Can I just say that pig looked very frightened when you arrived there? He saw a gentleman from the deep south. He thought, oh my God, I'm going to be on a spit and kind of spinning before I know what's happened to me. He hid when you arrived.
Oh gosh, I remember that. let me tell you something though.
Is this a pig story?
It is, in a sense, a pig story. Something that's making big news here today. Texas Monthly,
yes.
Texas being a state that I've lived in for a couple of years of my life, Texas Monthly is the state's big newspaper, or the state's big magazine. Anyway, they have just hired their first ever barbecue editor. So I think that in the spirit of good competition, I think it's only appropriate that Monocle brings someone in like this. I think we need to add a new position, whether it be barbecue editor or not, something along the lines of that, just in the nature of staying competitive with everyone across the world.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because in fact, let's be honest about this. You're departing from our New York bureau and you're heading south. You're going back to Alabama. Is that because you want to be our barbecue editor?
The idea of
or a deep fried chicken editor, that's what you'd be, wouldn't you?
I think that's only more appropriate. Deep fried chicken is something that I have far more experience with than barbecue, as you can tell just by looking at me. It's unfortunate that our listening audience can actually see what I look like. No, but in all seriousness, I've always loved these sort of funny titles like this. For instance, the American Literary Journal, the Paris Review, they have one of their editors is called the Southern Editor. And I think the guy's from Kentucky, but the idea of having a title like that, Southern Editor, it's really appealing to me. So if there's a way that we can keep me in as the barbecue editor, or the Southern editor, or the Alabama Farm Boy editor or something like that, I think...
The Alabama Farm Boy editor is on the masthead. Deal done. Open brackets.
Where do I sign?
Including deep fried chicken, close brackets. You're sorted. The business card is being printed. It's quite a lot of words to get on a business card. Barrett, always very nice to speak to you. That's Barrett Austin, who's our associate editor in New York, and a damn fine thing too. He's going to be our Southern editor shortly, and he'll be able to give you a drumstick when you ever head down to Alabama. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with some music and a look at the business stories with Bloomberg's Pim Fox.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design, and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. In a moment, international business stories, but first, it's Ben Westbeach with Let Your Feelings Go. Well, that was Let Your Feelings Go by Ben Westbeach. You're listening to Midori House. It's currently 18:43 here in London, which means it's 8:43 in the morning in Honolulu and 13:43 in Houston. Time now for a roundup of international business news with Pim Fox, anchor of Taking Stock on Bloomberg TV. Our news editor, Tom Edwards, caught up with Pim, who came bearing tales of technology takeovers and the current successes of the US economy. It seems that guns and food are both on the up.
I love the idea that the Pope says no to sadness. I wonder if Michael Dell is somehow channeling him right now, because Michael Dell probably is not all that happy, considering that, you know, the company, of course, it's got his name on it, that he wanted to take private in a $24 billion deal. Well, now there's someone else that wants to buy it. Carl Icahn and Blackstone Group, the big investment buyout firm, they've decided to team up, and they're going to put together a package for a purchase of Dell. And that means that, you know, it sort of would be like if you had your house and were nicely paying the bank all along for that nice big mortgage, and then finally you went to the bank and said, I'd like to buy it off. And the bank says, well, okay, sure, but, you know, because of the law, we have to put it up for public bid and see if anyone else wants to pay more for it. And it turns out, oh, yes, there might be someone who does want to pay a little bit more for your house, so you'll be out in the cold. Michael Dell certainly might not be out of the cold, because he's going to have 15% of the company, because that's how much he owns currently. But this whole idea of taking it private, from the public market is not going as smoothly as he may have previously expected. So maybe this idea of no to sadness from the Pope, maybe that'll buoy his spirits this week and give him an extra lift.
If only it was that easy, Pim. Yes. I just wonder, though, it was very important, wasn't it? Michael Dell was talking about how he wanted to try and shape the company's future by taking back more control. Do you think if some of these other investors investors get involved, it'll still be that easy for the company to move forward.
Yeah, right. That easy. Yeah, exactly. Just that easy. I hope everyone gets that note of irony in your voice. yeah, that easy. Well, I mean, the reality is, I don't know. Look around your office. I mean, how many Dell products do you have? How many Dell products do you have in your pocket? I'm not going there. But we've heard this all before. But they're in a commoditized product, and they've been trying to get into the services business because that's higher margin. It costs you more to call someone to come out and fix the washing machine in terms of margins and all that than it does to actually buy the machine in the first place. And they have not really been that successful at it because the technology moves so quickly. You don't fix anything anymore. You just buy a new one. So talking about new, we got a couple other things I just want to mention to you because you were talking about religion and football and meat, right? So it got me thinking about food, and this is just to characterize what's happening here in New York and I think in the United States is everyone's just focused on making a lot of money, as much money as they possibly can. And one of the things that's happening this week is the owner of Birdseye Frozen Peas is going public. It was bought by a private equity firm, and they think that the market is now ripe, so they're going to be selling that into the public. The makers of Bausch & Lomb, I don't know whether you got contact lenses, but they're also one of the big eye care companies. They're going public. Warburg Pincus owned them, and they're going to be sold to the public. So the idea is, while you talk about Cyprus, we say Cyprus, that's a tree. Europe is what we say to people on deck when they're just about to go to bat in a baseball game because we're focused on, spring training and baseball. So Europe is, I don't know, Europe, I guess. And, what's the other? Oh, a yen? I don't know. That's if you have, you want something. So we're really all about money. Money, guns and butter. And when I mean guns, it's real guns because it's, one of the big debates right now is on assault weapons bans in the wake of the school shooting in Connecticut. And that is creating a lot of tension and pressure on Congress to actually do something, whether they will or won't. That remains to be seen, but that's the big focus. It's guns, and then make as much money as you possibly can because tomorrow, what happens at the very end.
It's interesting stuff, Pim. I guess some of the people perhaps in Cyprus followed that kind of attitude, and it didn't really do them any favors.
Yes.
I just wondered on that, on the point about Cyprus, being marginally more serious for a moment.
But this is the way I think most business gets done, but that's another story. Go ahead.
What are the U.S. markets going to make then of the general ongoing problems in the Eurozone? Cyprus, just the tip perhaps of the latest iceberg. Is there concern on that side of the pond, or are people fairly sanguine about it?
I think that you're going to hear a lot of pundits, I'm going to be forced to say that. And a lot of pundits and a lot of headlines are going to say, if the Cyprus thing turned, they got a deal today, right? Supposedly. So the market went up. I mean, the only reason that markets go up or down is because people buy or sell. But I would bet you that most people, and I mean most successful people, and this isn't a bad thing, they couldn't locate Cyprus on a map with a flashlight. No, seriously. I mean, you're talking about a country that's got 23 billion euros? Isn't that the number being bandied around that they've got to come up with?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. Apple has 137 billion in cash. Now, a lot of that is even offshore, so they wouldn't even have to bring it back to the U.S. But, I mean, the scale of what we're talking about is so irrelevant. I mean, it's frightening to think about 23 billion. Do you know that Michael Dell wants to buy Dell for 24 billion? So, I mean, you put these numbers together and you go, well, Cyprus, it's a great headline, and we feel for the people there. And, if you want to put your card in the ATM and you can only get out, I think it was, how much can Tyler get out of the ATM? Because I think it was like a 260 euro limit or something like that. But can I mention one other thing about the booming housing economy in the United States? The last couple of days, I had the good fortune to go to what is called the Architectural Design Show at the 92nd Street Pier. It's this vast kind of convention hall thing. And, you're talking about a place where you could spend, if you wanted and if you got a raise, you could spend $15,000 on a very beautiful German refrigerator. I mean beautiful. And there were hundreds of these kinds of things, and charcoal grillers and flooring and art and tables and chairs. And there are a lot of people making a lot of great stuff. You know what I saw on the table of some of these? They put together these little presentations, right? These booths, these booths where they have tables and Monocle magazine.
Absolutely. We're everywhere, Pim.
You are. And it conveys a certain amount of hope and excitement that people want to make things, and people are buying them. I'm telling you, those $15,000 refrigerators, I think you should ask for a raise.
Well, that was Pim Fox, who was talking to our news editor, Tom Edwards, on The Briefing. And you have to remember that it's kind of like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning when Pim records that. I wonder what he's like at kind of 10 o'clock at night. Very, very, very good always having Pim on. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House. And welcome back. It's 18:50 here in London, and you're with Andrew Tuck. Now, stay with me for this bit, because you're going to find out a few things. Because the first question I have to ask you is, how do you measure a Brazilian? Well, it's a very difficult question, because Brazilians don't even know themselves what size they really are, because when they go shopping, there's no standardised sizing system. Now, for the first time, a new study by the Centre of Technology for the Chemistry and Textile Industries is measuring 10,000 Brazilians with the help of a human scanner, and it's going to release new guidelines for sizes by July. A documentary talking about this subject premiered last Friday in Brazilian cinemas, and director Paulo Pelicho believes Brazil doesn't have an official size guide because of the improvised way Brazilians deal with life, the so-called Jeitinho Brasileiro.
I was looking for a story, and I was always very interested in a Brazilian characteristic called the Jeitinho Brasileiro. It's a paradoxical characteristic. At the same time, we are very proud of this, and sometimes not so much. It's associated with creativity, but at the same time, this creativity sometimes gets a sense of permanent improvisation, in the sense that instead of resolving the problem, we just avoid the problem. It's useful for the short term, but not for the long term. It's the base of some of our problems in Brazil.
One of the problems mentioned is how the Brazilians choose their clothes. How problematic is that in Brazil?
I found that in Brazil we use large-scale foreign-size guidelines for our products, and they are mostly from Europe. Our consumer class 50 years ago were all European descendants, and it was easier to use those existent guidelines than to invest money in studies to measure the population and plan better. That's how we improvise, and it affects us a lot. Our industry practically makes clothes for a fictitious clientele in terms of body proportions and in other industries as well. The fact we never had a study of the average measure of a Brazilian, and because we are a very mixed country, this becomes a big problem.
Well, that was our Brazilian resident journalist Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking with director Paulo Pelicho about his film Farol do Figarino. Now, Fernando's here in the studio, and I have to ask you as a first question, how big are you?
Actually, Andrew, I know how big I am in England, but not in Brazil.
You don't know?
I really don't know. And I have to say, it is very stressful to go
shopping. I think you're small, actually. But anyway, when you go to the shops, do you get confused what to buy then?
Very confused. I can never go to a shop like, okay, can I have this size of trousers? Because I know they will be different. And it's funny because I was even talking to Paulo earlier today. He had problems as well buying. Honestly, it's a crazy situation in Brazil, and that's why I say that it's a very good market for tailors, because everyone go. I mean, if you go to Brazil, every street there's like two or three tailors that they'll be ready to do some small adjustments. It's not a surprise.
So is that confusion over sizes? Does that explain why you're sometimes wearing shorts in winter?
I think so, yeah. Now, that's a good point, Andrew.
Now, do you think that they haven't had a standardised system because they're trying to be a little bit complimentary about people? They don't want to say to anyone fat when you go in, so they don't say big. Or is that one of the reasons that they're trying to be nice to kind of Brazilian shoppers?
Certainly. Brazilians, they're well known for not being very direct. I remember even my father saying, actually, we never call someone fat, we call them a little bit strong.
A little bit strong.
Yeah, but never. It's true, but we never call someone fat.
I tell you, I've got a little bit strong in this office over the last few months.
It sounds better, no?
Yeah, much better.
So, and to be honest, actually, I think a lot of brands deliberately, they do their clothes larger, but then they say, oh, that's actually small. But then people will, psychologically, they'll think they're thinner.
Now tell me, okay, there's a problem to be sorted out. How come you get a film made about it?
It is. And it was a huge. I mean, it was released on Friday, and there's actually a lot of...
Are you sure it was huge? Maybe it was small, maybe it was medium. You just don't know.
And there was a lot of celebrities talking about, and actually the opening quote of the film is like a tailor saying, most people buy their clothes with the certainty that they will have to adjust them later. So it is a big problem. I mean, that's why we have even a documentary about that.
So I imagine Brazilian tailors aren't very happy with this. Because if people can suddenly buy clothes in the right size, then they won't need all the tailors.
Exactly. That's quite sad because, you know, you always have a friendly chat with your tailor. I remember when I lived in Brazil, I used to go there every week. You know, it's true, you know, like, and you make adjustments in everything, and not only like a proper suit. Even if you buy like a normal shirt, you know, like even if you go to the high street here in England, nobody would go to the tailor to make them in the perfect size. But yeah.
People should see Fernando, because Fernando kind of is a brightly coloured gentleman at the best of times, even in midwinter. You're in pink today, pink shirt today.
No need for tailor here.
Are you just saying tighter, aren't you? You want something neat and trim when you go to the tailors.
Exactly.
Whereas I'd be saying, can you put some elastic in those waistbands, please?
Exactly.
Now, the film's gone out in cinemas. How come it's got a cinematic release?
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of kind of important people talking about. There was some couple of MPs, some TV presenters like Adriane Galisteo saying that she was saying, oh, when I go to Paris, it's very easy. I know my size. I just say, give me like a trousers waist 31 or whatever. It's very easy. But when I'm in Brazil, I have absolutely no idea. And yeah, so.
And so when these sizings come out in July, so they're measuring 10,000 people.
They already measured 6.5. They just need to measure the other 3.5. They should measure me as well.
Where are they measuring them? Down at Copacabana Beach and Ipanema or?
They have actually a human scanner, which they imported, because that's what you do here in Europe and in the US as well. And Paulo was telling me as well that the results for the southeast region, which is where São Paulo and Rio are, actually they're going to be ready by the end of the month. But then for the rest of Brazil,
are they going to have state by state sizes?
Will. They will.
So it's not national. It's each state's going to have its own sizes.
There will be a national and then a more specific to the states, and that's quite interesting, Andrew, because as you probably know, Brazil is a very mixed country, which Paulo said earlier today as well. So, for example, when you're in the south in Santa Catarina, where the majority of the population are from German ancestry, they're quite tall
and big, stocky legs.
Exactly. Yeah. If you go up north, they're a little bit slimmer, and it's completely different. So
where? But you're from São Paulo.
I'm from São Paulo. I think I'm in between. I'm not sure if I'm. I mean, you say. Do you think? Yeah.
No,
I'm quite average.
I think you're certainly very slim. Now, just I think we're going to have to wrap this conversation up because it's bound to go into the territory that we shouldn't head into soon. Well, we did have the Brazilian ambassador here for lunch, didn't we?
Yeah.
Big.
Big. Yeah. Quite big. Stocky, good-looking man.
Maybe
yeah.
Very big. Anyway, we should have had him measured. We should have had him measured
exactly,
while he was here.
Exactly.
Anyway, that's been illuminating, hasn't it? That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Slim, I think, anyway. Small, maybe. Petite, even. Thank you very much for coming to see us. Well, you may be relieved to know that's all for today. We've had a great show. It was produced by Ali John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. I think she's small as well, probably. And Chris Fitch, definitely small, was our studio manager. Next up is Culture with Robert Bound. But that's all from me. Time to say goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.